His subject is Idol Worship in the 21st Century. This is class number 2, and the title of this class is Idolatry in the First Century. Brother Chris.
Thanks again, Greg. Further to Greg's comment about having the classes available on the audio, if anyone does want the PowerPoint slides, they can be made available as well. I'll make sure I leave them with Greg or something like that, so you can work that out. All right, we've moved forward a few thousand years. We're now looking at idol worship in the first century. We read from Ephesians chapter 5 there, and I'm hoping that even as that was being read, with the first class, it's starting to germinate some ideas there. We read verse 5 in the first class, covetousness, a covetous man is an idolater. There's a lot of ideas there, but really, it's summed up, isn't it, in verse 16, that we need to redeem the time because the days are evil. It's really all about time, ultimately, and what we dedicate our time to. Now, we've got on our introductory slide here a picture of Gladiator. So there he is in all his glory, standing in the Colosseum. And it's important for you to understand that what we're trying to say is what was going on in the first century is not all that different from today. And basically, the first number of slides we're going to go through, we're just looking at sort of the contrast, or remember the contrast, the similarity between life in the first century and our life today. And I didn't even have to make this one up. I didn't even have to make the connection myself to this one, because you've got to watch closely here. Here we go. We're going to superimpose. There we go. I didn't do that, brothers and sisters. I found that one. Someone else made that up. You can see the website there or whatever. People understand that what's going on today, the gladiators of today are football players. Now, I don't follow this too closely, but I understand there's some people here might be familiar with that picture there. I think SC stands for Southern California, from what I've been told. So it's a big deal. I guess if hockey is our god, football might be one of yours, depending where you are in the States. Baseball would rival it. But they see themselves in this context. That, you know, whether they're the gladiators in the arenas, the coliseums of the first century, here they are on the gridiron, and they're the champions, and it's a big deal. There's a picture of the Colosseum, the ruins of it anyway. It was called the Flavian Amphitheater in Rome, known in the Middle Ages as the Colosseum, held 45,000 people. Now we think some of the stuff is new. It's not. Okay, they were worshiping in their temples, as it were, their coliseums in those days. And again, you could pick all kinds of stadiums, and this is just one I happen to pick, sort of in an ironic kind of way. This is the Westpac Trust Stadium, opened in 2000, you know, the year 2000 in Wellington, that's New Zealand, and it was known as the Cake Tin. I don't know. I think that's kind of ironic kind of name for it. Kind of looks like one, though. Seating capacity, 33,500. And these were there in juxtaposition to each other, to contrast them. You know, this there's as the thing on the bottom, I'm not going to read the Latin to you, but it says there is nothing new under the sun. And it's true, brothers and sisters. Solomon said that. So what we're going to do is basically run through a day in the life, if you like, in the first century, and contrast it with what we see in the 21st century, and see that really not much has changed. We'll start with a city plan. This is Olympia. We're not going to go through it in detail, but sort of let your eyes take a wander through. As you walk in, there's the stadium, there's the colonnade, there's a temple or two in there, there's the priests' houses, and it was all laid out in terms of the structure of the city. And you know, you could take a modern city and look at its layout of its plan, and it'd have all its different features. And so we're going to take a wander through it. We're going to start in the stadium. It's interesting. Of course, the Olympics were recently in Athens again, and they literally went back to the place where some of these original stadiums were in Olympus. You can see the archaeological digs of it here. And they made a modern one for the whatever year that was. The Olympics were in Athens. And they model it directly. And so there's the stadium. And it was all about, you know, running the race and all the different events, high jump, long jump, all those things, and that the Olympic spirit that was there. And so again, the contrast, modern and ancient, not much has changed in 2,000 years. They modeled it directly on it, same kind of seating arrangement they wanted to look back. They see that as this, you know, that's their heritage, is these sporting events. And of course, we know Paul draws some lessons from this, and we'll try and draw out some spiritual lessons as we go through. He says in Hebrews 12, verse 1, "Wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and run with patience the race that is set before us." And so he draws lessons from the various different sporting events, whether it's running or whatever the case might be. The point is, I guess, for us is, do we see these things, these events, things that are going on, and do we take the spiritual lessons from them and put them into practice? Or are we actually more caught up in the sport and the thrill of the sport, literally, and sort of lose sight of the fact that Paul's only alluding to these different things to make spiritual lessons or to make a point that way? Let's go back to the Colosseum for a moment. There's an older picture of the ruins of the Colosseum. And you may or may not have known, but the Mississippi State University Coliseum, as they call it, what's it called there, the Humphrey Coliseum, they actually modeled it exactly on the ancient Coliseum in Rome, dimension-wise. And again, I'll just go back, I guess. I'll see if I can do this. There we go. And we tried to make the pictures about the same size. It's actually modeled on it. Again, so, I mean, has much changed? It hasn't, has it? You know, and we can see here, you know, they're entertained by competition and violence. Again, I'm not making any sort of comment on whichever particular sport you may be interested in, but essentially it's entertainment, it's competition, and there's an element of violence. If it's, you know, the human spirit and the human form is worshipped, and there's the gladiator running out, you know, to the cheers of the crowd as they gathered around. You know, and whether it's the football player running through the blocks, whatever, that's what takes place in the Colosseum. 2,000 years apart, the same thing's happening. Another little anecdotal story. There's a brother that we know quite well back home. And he said to his boss, he got a new job, and he said to his boss, "I don't want to work on Sunday because it's my day of worship." And to which his boss replied, "Well, I don't really like working on Sunday either because NASCAR is my religion." And again, quite openly, you know, that's what he wants to do on Sunday is watch cars rip around a track. And that was his religion. Well, what do we learn about what went on in the Colosseum? Again, Paul draws an allusion. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 4, he says, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." And he said in 1 Corinthians 15, "I fought with beasts at Ephesus." And the analogy is being thrown into the arena, you know. And there he is, and he's fighting with beasts. But it's not a literal warfare. It's a spiritual one. It's about imaginations and anything that exalts itself against God. And I guess we have to sort of ask ourselves, you know, which fight excites us more, the literal boxing match, or the standing up for truth, for pulling down strongholds? You know, not carnal warfare. That's not the kind of weapons that we want to develop. You know, we have to think of what are we training our children in? You know, what skills are we leaving them with? Are we leaving them with skills so that they can excel in these kind of arenas of worldly glory? Are we giving them the kind of skills that they can stand up for what they believe? They know the truth. They bring into captivity the thoughts that would you know, take them away from the truth. You know, those are the kind of skills, those are the kind of abilities that we need to manifest in our own lives. And, you know, in a lot of ways, you can't really blame the children in all this, because sometimes it's the parents that have gotten involved in an early age. While we were homeschooling Josiah when he was younger, we did put him into hockey as a sort of recreation or phys ed program when he was nine. And I ended up having to coach because they split the team into two and said, well, we need someone to coach you. Would you do it? I said, I know nothing about hockey. That's okay. You can coach him. Anyway, they sent me off to some things to learn the skills and whatnot. But I tell you, I don't know if you've ever been in a hockey arena. The parents are unbelievable. They are all over the referee. They're yelling at the kids. They're just, you'd think it was like the Stanley Cup, you know. And here we're literally playing, the arena that's up the road from us is literally a barn that they've put an arena in, some ice on a sheet of ice. It's a backwater, nothing place, and they're yelling and screaming like there's no tomorrow. And you can hardly blame the kids. Where did that come from? I don't know. Let's move on from there. Well, I don't think anyone's going to get left out today. So if I haven't sort of pricked your conscience yet, I'm sure we will at some point. The theater. Well, there they are. There's some ancient, some archaeological digs of theaters in various different places. Amazing, really. And again, this is, you know, these are thousands, you know, these are from the turn of, the time of Christ and before, some of these. Amazing. The architecture, you know, the amphitheaters, all the acoustics, you know, they really were advanced. You know, we think somehow, these things were all primitive. They were the modern technology of their day. Again, in Hebrews, Paul is the writer, says, partly, whilst you were made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly, whilst she became companions of them that were so used. The only reason we have of this passage here, this word gazing stock is the Greek word theatizo. Basically, it's the word theater. So the word theater is used, as it were, in our New Testament scriptures there. And there's a particular one at Ephesus, the theater at Ephesus. Now, it's interesting. I want you to notice it's very similar to the previous pictures, the arrangements of the seats, kind of circular around the center there. I don't know if anyone happens to know the Latin word for theater. The Greek word is theater. Here's our modern theaters. Now, do you have Cineplex Odeon down here? This is big in Canada anyway, Cineplex Odeon. Notice their symbol. It's actually based on the theaters of ancient Greece and so on. You can see it's sort of like these rings, okay? And the Latin word for theater is Odeon. So they've picked it right up, and they said, okay, people used to go and watch the show, you know, out in the open there with the amphitheater all around and what's going on down on the stage there. Well, we've got the same thing today. Newer technology, all that kind of thing, but here we are. So we have our Odeons too. They get their shape from the logo, the shape of the seating of the original theater in Ephesus. So there it is, idol worship, as it were. First century, 21st century, same thing. They even have the same name, theater and Odeon. Now, Paul's little comment there says, you know, we were made a gazing stock. You know, we were their show, right? Like they brought Samson in to make sport. They rushed into the theater, and in fact, Paul wasn't allowed to go. They held him back, and he says, you know, this was all because of what we preached. You know, we were on show before. They wanted to hear the words, as it were, but some were sincere and some weren't. So we ask ourselves, sort of, which side of that are we on? Are we preaching the word such that sometimes people might think us a bit strange? Kind of think we're putting on a bit of a show, maybe even laugh behind our back. Have we made ourselves known in that way? And in whatever it might be, whether we're at school, whether at work, whether it's with a neighbor, whatever place we are we, as it were, cast into the limelight there to put forth what we believe? Or would we rather be the spectator watching someone else's performance in one of these places? Let's not kid ourselves. The ideas that are put forward in whatever show it might be, whether it's live theater or movie theater or whatever, it's the philosophies of man that are being put forward. And oh yeah, some of them have some good lessons. We say, well, at least that one had no swearing in it. And, you know, we watch these things. But primarily, if we were really honest with ourselves, these things are putting forth to the glory and honor of men and women. Or they're just outright, you know, licentious and immoral. But even the ones that have good lessons in them, you know, we have to really watch, you know, what we watch. And, of course, the thing about these places, and you must have them where there's like 10 or 15 screens in one of these places. You know, you walk in and, you know, you might be going to see one particular show, but you go in there and you're bombarded with the world. There's everything in there, every kind of entertainment, every kind of, and of course, they're all very graphically portrayed. So you might be going to see this particular movie, you know, that's a family-rated movie, but the R-rated one is right there with its advertisement poster. You know, and we take our children right into there. You have to really wonder, you know, what it is that we're thinking we're accomplishing by doing so. So, that's the theater. Well, we'll move on to the arena. Fairly a sort of similar idea, I guess, to the Colosseum, but the arena, as we know, is where they took believers, right? And they were believers and others, and they were put on a show. It was a bloodthirsty show. This one would probably make more sense in Canada, I guess, but there's the arena today. That's the Air Canada Centre. Toronto's now famous for it. And again, just sort of looking at it's the same, probably about the same dimensions as well. And it's about seeing a good show. And if you happen to like hockey, I guess it is a pretty good show. Notice up here what we've got hanging in the banners are all the idols, you know, all the superstars, all the people that are getting honor. They're the gods of today. We give them honor. We retire their numbers. We you know, put them in a place of prominence. We list all their accomplishments. It's giving honor to men's accomplishments. That's what it's all about. And you know, just to harken back a little bit, I guess, to what we talked about in the first class, you know, are we willing to sacrifice ourselves, our children, to this kind of place? It's challenging for sure. Because when we compare what we've been called to in 1 Corinthians 1, you know, it's not that we, it says, see your calling, brethren, not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble. We're not called to these sort of, these things are all the human spirit that makes people feel good about themselves. God's chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty. All right, so there's a great difference between what God honors and what society honors. And we have to really see where our alliance lies, our allegiance lies. It says he's chosen the base things of the world and the things which are despised, the things which are not, to bring to naught the things that are. And the reason, and this is the key point, 1 Corinthians 1, verse 29, that no flesh should glory in his presence. That's the point. And all those other things we were looking at, all the sporting accomplishments, the gold medals, the World Series championships, the Little League championships, you know, the little local whatever championship, it's giving glory and honor to people, to men, to women, to boys, to girls. And God has arranged things that no flesh should glory in his presence. I've been harping on the sports quite a bit, which probably takes out most of the males in the audience, feeling kind of low, kind of like I've been beating on you. One thing I should say, I was going to preface this whole thing saying, don't think I've got this all figured out. The reason, what I'm giving you today is one person struggling with these things. You know, I love sports as much as the next person. I coach basketball back home. You know, I don't claim to have all the answers, and I certainly don't figure it out. But I do know we've tried. We've pulled our son out of hockey. You know, that was just the commitment to that was just too great. So, but at the same time, that's maybe more of the male thing. So we'll move along to the first century where they had the mall. Now, that may be a caricature that women have more trouble at the mall. I like going shopping too, you know, and so it's. But perhaps in the sort of stereotype, we've got the mall. And here we go. This is the mall at Philippi. A lot of these slides, by the way, I got from Brother Jonathan Bowen. He did a study up at Manitoulin and on the letters to the seven ecclesias. So he went through and gets these pictures from the various seven ecclesias, and it was a great. We did it the same year we did Josiah at Kids Camp, and it was a good segue, one from the other. But here we go. They got all the different stalls, and you could go along. She walked along the way, and each of the people sold their different wares in the different stalls. You could have anything you wanted as you went there. And of course, today they look a little bit different. They might look something like that. But they're all there, and it's the mall. We call it the mall. We go shopping, the shopping mall, whatever the case might be. Bigger, better, grander. They're just unbelievable edifices. And what's it all to? It's to the almighty dollar. It's to turn a profit. It's capitalism. And we can't pretend it doesn't affect us. Just recently in the readings, at the end of last year, we were reading through Job. Just turn back to Job chapter 31. Because again, we tend to probably think that, you know, we're doing okay. You know, we're not committing adultery. We haven't murdered anybody recently. We group things and especially, you know, we don't have the problem. There might be some people have the problem, but it's not us. But we've got to see, and we saw those lists of the works of the flesh, and idolatry was mentioned, covetousness was mentioned, you know, things that exclude from God's kingdom. It's coming up over and over and over again. And here in Job, chapter 31, let's go over to verse 24. And he's talking about the kind of parameters he set on his own life, the kind of lifestyle he lived. He says in Job 31, 24, "If I have made gold my hope, or have said to fine gold, thou art my confidence, if I rejoiced because my wealth was great, and because mine hand had gotten much, if I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon walking in brightness, and my heart hath been secretly enticed, or my mouth has kissed my hand, this also is an iniquity to be punished by the judge, for I should have denied the God that is above." Do you notice what he's just lumped together? A bunch of things. So worshiping the sun, moon, and stars in some sort of pagan heathen ritual is as equally reprehensible to Job as trusting in gold and silver and his wealth. So again, it's all a matter of where our trust is. All right. So if I said to gold, "You are my confidence," I've just replaced God. Because God is to be our confidence. Now, that's not to say we may not have money. Abraham was a rich man. There's all kinds of examples. But it's where is your trust? Where is your confidence? And only you can answer that for yourself, where you're at in that regard. The point being here that covetousness, greed, or worshiping the stars and bowing down to idols, Job lumps them all together. And he sees them as, what is it? He said at the end of verse 28, "If I do these things, if I trust in gold, if I trust in my wealth, if I bow down to idols, I've denied God." That's the point. And in our lives, we have to be careful that we don't deny our Maker. The mall. You probably can't read all this. I'll read it. It's a little comic. It's a man going out the door on his way to work, and his wife calls after him, "Remember, Theodore, it's not if you win or lose that counts, but how much money you make." You know, that's really the philosophy of our age, isn't it, brethren and sisters? Jesus said this, Luke 12:15, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of things which he possesses." I would suggest to you the mantra of our world, especially our Western world, is that a man's life does consist in the abundance of things that he possesses. You're measured by it. The kind of car you drive, the size of your house, how much money you make. These are a measure of you as a man or a woman, of your accomplishments, your status, you know, what degrees you have or letters that come after your name. This is how people measure each other. Jesus says the exact opposite. A man's life consisteth not in the abundance of things that he possesses. The common phrase today, and you've probably seen this on t-shirts or whatever, "He who dies with the most toys wins." That's capitalism, right? Whoever dies with the most toys wins. The nice little comeback to that, of course, is he who dies with the most toys still dies. Jesus, as we've alluded to this one further earlier, he said, you can't serve two masters. You either love the one, hate the one and love the other, or you'll hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now, mammon was actually the Chaldean god of wealth. And if you have a modern translation, Matthew 6:24 simply says, you cannot serve God and money. Can't do it. You know, we like to try, though, I think, and we're just brought up into it. We're just brought up in it, in our world. We lack for nothing. Money is seen as the ticket, as it were, to a good life. You know, the American dream, as it's called. Work hard, gain money, and die happy. It's a false premise, brethren and sisters, because it's exact opposite of what Jesus says. You cannot serve God and mammon. And a man's life isn't measured based on the abundance of things which he has. How much stuff you got is irrelevant to Jesus and will not save you in any way in the last day. But it could take you away from a hope for eternal life. All right, let's move on. The spa and the gym. There's the spa at Ephesus and the gym at Sardis. You know, it's interesting. Let's just go over to 1 Timothy chapter 4. You know, this is, it's interesting that people used to, you know, even in a previous generation or two, worked hard in an outdoor sort of environment, agricultural society, and they didn't need the spa or the gym to get physically fit because they just were by the nature of their work. Now, in our sort of the kind of society we live in, you need these sort of places to get into shape because your job doesn't help you get into shape. So we have all kinds of places. You can go to the spa and relax. You can go work out in the gym, or you can even, you know, pump some iron at home. You know, they say that if you spend an hour a day working out, you can add 5 years to your life. Now, the interesting thing is, do the calculation, all 5 years were spent exercising. So I don't know what you accomplished. You know, and Paul says that here in 1 Timothy 4, verse 8. For bodily exercise profiteth little. And actually, in the margin, says profits for a little time. You know, and we should be encouraged to keep our body in shape and so on and so forth. You know, I think that's a good thing. A healthy body and a healthy mind, that's all good. But again, it's the emphasis. He says, look, bodily exercise profits but for a little time, but godliness is profitable in all things, having promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come. I thought to myself, imagine if we took the investment of time that we take in exercising ourselves in the spa or the gym, if we applied that same quantity of time and quality of time to the things in the truth, what would the return on that investment be? It'd be huge, wouldn't it? We go to the marketplace in Smyrna there. You know, yes, we need to buy our food and so on and our day-to-day goods. This is, you know, we can't. It's not quite like the mall where you're just usually window shopping because you can't afford any of the stuff that you're looking at, but it's just kind of fun to go and look anyway. Here, the market. We need to buy things that we need. And we've got our modern markets today. I don't know what place this is. It's some Walmart or something. It's an absolutely massive building. I don't know how many acres it takes up, but you can see a little bit of perspective of size. I mean, here's the vehicles parked out in front. Mammoth buildings we have just to take care of our needs. But what did Jesus say? So take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewithal shall we be clothed? Does that mean we don't bother going and buying our stuff? Certainly not. We have to, you know, go to the store and buy it. But we're not taking anxious thought. That's not what we're consumed with. You know, what we shall eat, or what we shall drink, or what we're going to be clothed with. Then Jesus says, interestingly, Matthew 6:32, for after these things to the Gentiles seek. The implications are that we shouldn't be seeking after these things. This shouldn't be the focus of our life. For your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God. Priorities. Focus. What's at the center? Seek ye first the center, the proton, and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. You know, do we actually practice that, brethren and sisters? You know, we can recite that passage. Our children in Sunday school can recite verse 33 of Matthew 6. Right? We have them have it committed to memory. But do we actually practice it? Do we try and put it into practice where we actually make an effort not to be anxious about food and clothing and drinking? Clothing is a big one, especially for my teenage children at the moment. right? It's all about what you look like, and it's a focus. All right, it's an obsession at times. Unless we put that into practice, brothers and sisters, it's not going to happen by default. Just being able to recite the verse, just knowing it, won't make it automatically happen. We have to actually make an effort to try to believe what Jesus said there. Another one of Brother Jonathan Bowen's slides here. And this is to the ecclesia at Laodicea. Jesus says, "Thou art neither cold nor hot. And because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Because you said, I'm rich, I'm increased with goods, I have need of nothing. And you know not that you're wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked." And he counsels them to go and get the things that really matter. And to me, that's a description of certainly our Western world in general and Christadelphia in North America. That can happen, that we can feel we've taken care of business, as it were. We've got it all figured out. We're like the man building the bigger barns. And we kind of see things stretching on before us and, yep, it's good. I got it, you know, this is what I'm going to do. It's all planned out. It's all laid out. I'm rich. I'm increased with goods. I really don't need anything. In a materialistic sense, that may be true. The problem with materialism, brethren and sisters, the problem with being bombarded in a society that pushes these things is our spiritual sensibility, our spiritual vitality can become dulled. The abundance of all these things actually dulls the spiritual man. And all of a sudden we can't see things as clearly as we used to see things. Things can sort of slip under the radar, as it were, because we're not alert. We've been dulled by this prosperity that we live in. And I'm no different in that matter than you. The University at Ephesus, they had their centers of learning. They had their wisdom of their world, Plato, Aristotle, Julius Caesar, and we're no different today. And does that mean we don't go get an education? It's not what I'm saying, and I'm sorry if you've misunderstood that. These things have their place, but we got to be aware of them. And anyone who's been through university knows you got to be on your guard. It's so easy to get sucked in by the wisdom of this world. And what did Paul say about the wisdom of this world? It's foolishness with God. Let's not kid ourselves. And there's a bit of a trend, even in the brotherhood today, that brothers who have PhDs or this or that or the other thing are somehow, oh boy, they write better. And their articles in the magazines, well, they just make more sense. And we can't think that, brethren and sisters. If it's not based on God's word, If it's not a brother who's had his mind immersed in God's word, and it's that's what's coming forth. If it's the wisdom of this world, then it might, no matter how good it sounds, it may not be right, and we really need to just watch out for that. You've been really good keeping on time. I think I'm okay time wise. A few more minutes here, Greg. I wouldn't want to. Upset your great effort to keep things on track here. We've covered a bunch of things there, brethren and sisters, and hopefully all of us at some point thought, ouch, you know, that kind of hit a little close to home. Because it does to me. Many of those hit very close to home for me. We were just talking about this. The wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 19. 2 Corinthians, In whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them. The God of this world, brethren and sisters, and whichever one it might be for you, whichever one you're struggling with, whichever idol is taking the place of God, you know, the Lord of your life, the King in your life. The problem is, it blinds us. It can blind us. It obscures our view. And so this glorious gospel of Christ, this light of Christ that can shine for us, is a light that shines out of darkness, doesn't shine so brightly. We've got too many other things sort of filtering out that light. And, you know, we just have to really honestly ask ourselves, are we blinded by these gods? We're going to talk, as the day unfolds, about, you know, how we combat these things. So I don't want to always be negative in all this. It's really, we've tried to be a bit stark in the contrast. This is what they've done in the past. We kind of almost laugh at the imagery of people bowing down to gods. It seems so primitive. So we've tried to really sort of a bit of shock value that these things are still here with us today. And this is one of those. You may want to turn this up. It's in Jeremiah chapter 7. And just to actually see it on your page, although I'm going to have the passages up here, I have family time question mark. And I guess I'm at kind of this stage now where, you know, you've got children, there's things to do with your kids, and family time's important, quality family time. I would suggest to you that we can get taken away by this. It's another one of the world's kind of ways of getting at you. They say, you know, if you can spend time with your family, that kind of justifies everything else. And we like to justify things. So here in Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 16, "Therefore pray not for this people." This is God speaking to Jeremiah. "Don't pray for this people," he says, "neither lift up a cry or prayer for them, neither make intercession to me, for I will not hear thee. Seest thou not what they do in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem?" This is God talking to Jeremiah. "Open your eyes. Don't you see what they're doing? The children gather wood. The fathers kindle the fire. The women knead their dough to make cakes to the Queen of Heaven and to pour out drink offerings unto other gods that they may provoke me to anger." This was family time, brothers and sisters. They're all involved. The mom's doing her thing. The dad's doing his thing. They're all coming together. The focus is to bring honor and glory to God? No, to pour out drink offerings unto other gods. And I just think we need to be challenged by that. Just because we're together as a family doing something, calling it family time, it may not be a very good use of that family time. And we think of, the sport's a classic example. And you know, oh, well, I'm taking my son to this thing, so it's okay because we're together and we're involved together. Now, that may be valuable in building a relationship. But what sort of things do you talk about? Do you talk about the fact that, well, okay, you know, we've made a commitment to this team and we'll help them out, but, you know, if their game is during youth group or on a Sunday morning during Sunday school, you're not going. Do we use the opportunity to teach them about priorities and commitment? So, like, there's family time and there's family time. We may go away on a vacation, and it may be 100% indulgent, but it's family time. But, boy, it was fun, and we did all the things. We looked just like the family in the hotel room beside us. Or do we take that time to reinforce some family values? Do we, you know, make sure the readings get done? Do we contrast what else is going on out there and say, look, we're not going to go and do what everyone else is doing, even though we're here in this, you know, holiday situation? You can see, the just because we're with family and it's called family time doesn't make it right, because it wasn't right in Jeremiah's time. God said to Jeremiah in verse 19, "Do they not provoke me to anger?" Oh, it was family time, but they were provoking God to anger. And that was a rhetorical question, actually. And he said, "Do they not provoke themselves to the confusion of their own faces?" They think that's all okay. They think everything's fine, but they're going to find out how wrong they were. Two more slides. Judges 3, and we've got the banner here, "There's nothing new under the sun" again. This is Judges chapter 3. "The children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites." Now, I don't know all the names of the communities or the people surrounding us here today, so fill in what you like. "The children of Israel, the people of God, the Christadelphians in California, near Los Angeles, dwelt among the..." And there's all the list of all the communities and peoples and whatever they are. "They took their daughters to be their wives and gave their daughters to their sons and served their gods. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served Balaam and the groves." Well, that was the people of God in Judges. And we're saying, you know, flash forward several thousand years, we are in danger of doing the same thing if we think we can sort of intermingle with impunity. We can't. It didn't work for those people. And I think their motives were probably pure to start with. They probably didn't think it was going to happen, that they would be taken away from serving God. But slowly, 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 as their resolve was whittled away, as their eyes became blinded. And how serious? I mean, we have the phrase, you know, we're to be in the world, not of the world. Okay? That's what we need to do. We can't help the fact that we're surrounded. God brought them into this land, and they were surrounded by all these other people. But the trouble is, they became in the world and of the world. So they became indistinguishable, and God had to take them away. Jesus said, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? And we have to be challenged by that passage. What could it possibly be that there wouldn't be faith on the earth? I mean, we can count up the number of Christadelphians there are in this small area here. How could there not be faith on the earth? And yet, Jesus challenged us with that question. Well, it may be that we're indistinguishable from the communities around us, as it were. I guess the challenging question to end with for this one is, we all worship something. Who, or perhaps what, is it that you worship? Thank you.